Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open helping promote a brand new and proven effective program that'll soon be available at 9 different locations across the state to help teens and their loved ones face and tackle substance abuse. We'll hear from a clinical director at the Children's Center of Hamden about Smart Recovery, a free abstinence-oriented peer support system based on cognitive behavioral approaches to recovery. Then, as the governor's State of the State address and its preceding budget proposal continue to echo in the ears of Connecticut lawmakers, we'll check in with Senator Tony Huang to learn about a number of ideas the governor pitched this week that are literally keeping him up at night. And we'll close with our second check-in with Sacred Heart University's new Institute for Public Policy, which just released its second survey of state residents on their feelings about the quality of life here in Connecticut. We'll review the results and how they're tied to concerns about how the current state budget is doing very little to improve residents' morale or their financial well-being. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. The Arts Hero Awards honor Connecticut residents who are doing extraordinary things in or for or through the arts. The 2018 Arts Hero Awards theme is resiliency, that ineffable quality that allows some people to be knocked down by life and come back stronger than ever. Do you know a special someone, a hero who's resilient and is doing extraordinary things in for or through the arts in their community? If your answer is yes, nominate them for a 2018 Arts Hero Award. You can learn more at the Connecticut Office of the Arts at cultureandtourism.org or by completing the nomination form on or before Friday, March 23rd at surveymonkey.com/smallr/Arts Hero Awards. Well, we're going to open up our program this morning talking to a brand new friend who I think we're going to be talking to on a regular basis. Christine Hauser is on the line with us. She is based at the Children's Center of Hamden, and she's clinical director of the Wakeman Hall Substance Abuse Treatment Initiative. We're here today to talk to folks about a brand new initiative called Smart Recovery Connecticut, which is hosting meetings at 9 different locations across the state, including the Children's Center of Hamden. And it's a free abstinence-oriented peer support group based on behavioral approaches to addiction recovery. Christine has great expertise and a lot of resource in terms of what maybe parents and caregivers, educators, and others in the community who care about how both the opioid crisis and other addiction issues are impacting our youngest people, who are really at the point where they are at a crossroads, or at least a fork in the road, and so many of them, either due to peer pressure or the idea that they could shake it or it's not going to be an issue for them, it's just experimentation with drugs or other substances, is not going to be a big deal. And then a year or two or five down the road, we find we've got a clinically addicted individual. So, Christine, thanks for coming on this morning and talking with us about this critically important issue, the place we are right now in 2018, and this exciting new initiative, which I understand was funded through something called the CROSS Initiative?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the CROSS Initiative and a little bit of an overview of the Smart Recovery Program, and then we'll hear a little bit about the agency you represent.
Sure. So CROSS is the Connecticut Recovery-Oriented Support System for Youth. It is a brand new grant that was given to 9 different sites across the state of Connecticut. And each site is going to be launching smart recovery groups, either a teen smart recovery group or a young adult smart recovery group, and then a family and friends smart recovery group. And in addition to that, the CROSS Initiative is also going to be doing something called an alternative peer group. So each site will also host basically fun activities that help young people meet other people who are trying to make changes, and it also supports them in being sober long term because they're making connections with people that are, you know, hopefully healthier and not centered around substance use.
Okay, and how does that dovetail into the larger mission of the Children's Center of Hamden?
Yeah, so the Children's Center of Hamden, we are a nonprofit agency. We've been around since 1833, and we offer a lot of different programs for young people who are, you know, struggling and have different life challenges that require a little bit more support for them. And we have a lot of different programs that support young people. The program in particular that I oversee supports young people ages 12 to 18 who use substances. And we, you know, offer outpatient support and intensive outpatient support depending on how often they're using substances or how much, you know, disruption it's caused their lives. And we figure out basically how to meet them where they're at, how to help them move into a more positive direction, in a direction that they're willing to, and then we help them to do that. The biggest thing is that we try to connect them to things in their community, you know, families or things in their school or activities that they really enjoy that make it a lot easier to stop using substances.
The thing that I have been hearing more and more about from people in your profession and like to try to reiterate for the many folks that might be listening across Connecticut is the still lingering stigma or misconception that the major bulk of the demographic who are addicts are, you know, kind of 30 to 60 something inner city or minority individuals, when I've been brought to understand that especially the opioid addict in Connecticut today is a late teen or 20 something Caucasian upper middle class to upper class male.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting about substance use is it really does affect all walks of life. It looks different for every different population that it touches. You know, substance use in the inner city looks very different from substance use in the suburbs, but it certainly is present in all areas. And, you know, when you speak specifically to the opioid crisis, we absolutely are seeing young people in treatment who are using opioids. I think because of accessibility of pain medication, I think people are able to start younger and younger and then really can benefit from support younger and younger.
And even from some of the parents of these young people who have been on the program, some of them literally breaking down in tears over the fact that, you know, basically my kid just got wisdom teeth pulled, his first ever dental procedure, or, you know, my kid, all he ever really wanted to do was play soccer, and he went and he played soccer, and he did great for a couple of years, and then he fell and he had an ankle injury, and the doctor said the pain medication we're going to give him will get him through these hard first couple of weeks, and then he'll be fine. And once again, as I said earlier, a few months, a few years later, there's trouble.
Absolutely. You know, there are so many different ways that, you know, young people can access substances. You know, one way is through getting prescriptions themselves from doctors or physicians or dentists, you know, but they can also access medication and medicine cabinets at home as well. And they can also oftentimes get different substances, whether it be opioids or other substances, from peers that they know at school. There are a lot of different ways that they can connect with them. And I think the other piece to it is that a lot of them don't think that substance use is as problematic. There's a lot of evidence showing that with the legalization of marijuana in particular, that their perceptions of how harmful substances are has decreased in recent years. And that there is, you know, potentially more experimentation happening. And if there's not more experimentation happening, there's a perception that it's not as harmful.
Mm. How much of the, I was going to say, in your experience at the Children's Center of Hamden, which is one component of this, actually the first location to host the Smart Recovery meetings just a week or so ago, before they started expanding to these other eight locations across the state, what are you seeing from the front lines in terms of areas of concern? Are opioids still kind of the big deal with marijuana, alcohol, and then, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 other things kind of following along behind in very incremental fashion? Or are you actually seeing a bigger problem with things like marijuana and alcohol, where opioids may have leveled off or are even diminishing in terms of the challenges?
Yeah, we are seeing all sorts of substance use. I would say that most of the kids that we see are using marijuana and or alcohol, or started using marijuana or alcohol. So that is still pretty significant. And we are seeing a decent amount of young people who are using lots of other substances, you know, including pills, which along with marijuana being used for medicinal reasons, young people often look at pills that doctors prescribe and think that they are less harmful as well, because it's a medicine that's prescribed by a doctor. And they don't always understand that it's prescribed for a specific purpose, and using it for other purposes can have side effects. So, you know, we absolutely are seeing pill usage and uses of lots of other substances, but what we're seeing now in particular is pill usage that can turn into heroin use in particular. Mm. So, you know, a young person might have access to medication for pain, you know, an opioid prescription medication for themselves or for a family member, or maybe they buy them off the street, but it's much less expensive to use heroin than pills. So we're seeing a big switch to that. And I think we've always seen it in the young person population, but we are seeing much more overdoses. And we are seeing that transition between pills and heroin a lot more.
Okay. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left with Christine Hauser. She's with the Children's Center of Hamden and is their clinical director for the Wakeman Hall Substance Abuse Treatment Program. The Children's Center of Hamden was the very first of 9 locations to begin hosting Smart Recovery meetings. Smart Recovery is a free abstinence-oriented peer support group based on cognitive behavioral approaches to addiction recovery. If you are anywhere near New Haven, you can find Smart Recovery meetings at a location on Howe Street on Mondays, in West Haven at the American Legion on Monday evenings, at the VA hospital in West Haven, as well as other locations, including UCC in Southbury, the Hageman Memorial Library in East Haven. There's a teen meeting. This is the one that we're talking about in Hamden, and a number of other meetings across the state. You can get all that information if you go to smartrecoveryct.org/meetings. But while we have Christine on the line, we want to shift gears and spend the rest of the 4 or 5 minutes that we have with her digging in a little bit deeper to the nuts and bolts of the Smart Recovery Program, why it has been granted for these groups by the CROSS Initiative, and exactly why it's working so well, Christine.
Yeah, we are so excited to be the first site to launch the teen and family and friends meetings in Connecticut. We started at our site on the 29th of January. So I would be happy to talk a little bit more about why we're so excited about these meetings. You know, substance use stigma is alive and well. I think people often think that substance use is an issue that it's a choice that somebody makes to do something what we're really understanding is that substance use is actually something that triggers changes in your brain. So when we use substances, it's very difficult to quit. It's much more than willpower. It takes much more than willpower in order to change substance mm-hmm. use. Mm-hmm. So these meetings are a nice way of being an open door. People can come in anonymously. They don't even have to be willing to go to treatment. And they can go to a meeting where someone is trained and oftentimes has had addiction personally impact their life, either them or through a family member. And they're able to set up an environment where people can meet other people going through the same situation. They can learn some skills or tools to help them make changes. And they can do it without the fear of being judged or other people knowing what's going on with them. So it's a nice way. We offer treatment here at the Children's Center, but there are so many people that don't even make it through the door at treatment because of their concerns about what will happen or what people will think about them. Mm. So this is a nice way for people to get help and support who aren't ready for treatment and to be able to make changes if they think that they would like to do that.
And while we're heading into just as we broadcast this, probably the third week of Monday night meetings at the Children's Center of Hamden, the thing that strikes me is that young people really seem a lot more flexible in terms of diminishing that stigma. So hopefully one of the things that the Smart Recovery meetings will do out of the Children's Center of Hamden is kind of plant the seed amongst individuals who will then go out peer-to-peer and begin to put the word out that this resource is available to folks, and it's kind of an accepting, non-judgmental environment where people can go and really explore the various opportunities to get the help that they need to change their lives.
Absolutely. You know, I think that there is, Smart Recovery, you listed several of the meetings that are happening in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah.
They're typically being offered to adults. So what's really unique about this initiative is that they're available for teens and family and friends of teens. A lot of people haven't heard of Smart Recovery. A lot of people are much more familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous.
Right.
Smart Recovery is similar to those meetings in that it's a group of people. It's not connected to treatment. There's a lot of peer-to-peer support, as you mentioned. But what's different about Smart Recovery is different in some ways. Some of the ways that it's different is that they don't follow the 12 steps. You're not required to believe in the higher power at the Smart Recovery meetings.
Yeah, faith-based kind of foundation.
Yeah. You know. It teaches specific tools so people can walk away from a group, not only meeting other people who are in the same situation, which is just extremely helpful, but they can walk away with a tool that they can then use to make changes if they would like to do that. The program has a 4-point recovery plan. They build and maintain motivation, address coping with urges, managing thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and living a balanced life. And so I think with all of those things combined, this approach, I think, is just a little bit more easily accessible to young people. And the family and friends group is also really exciting because you not only does substance use and addiction affect the life of the person who's using, but it affects the lives of the people who live with them or are close to them or who love them.
Or employ them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so these family and friends meetings are, it's an opportunity to get support, to meet other people in the same situation, but they also draw from an evidence-based approach that's been researched and shown to be effective called the CRAFT, the Community Reinforcement and Family Training Approach.
Mm-hmm.
And this approach has a 60% success rate for getting a loved one into treatment.
Wow.
60% might sound like a low number, but when you really understand addiction, that's an incredible rate.
Yeah, and you break it down to 6 out of 10, and then you start multiplying that by hundreds. and that's why we see that's why they call it smart recovery. So Christine Hauser's been our guest in our opening segment this morning. She's with the Children's Center of Hamden. She's the clinical director of the Wakeman Hall Substance Abuse Treatment Initiative at that location, which is also the very first location in Connecticut to host smart recovery for teens and friends and family. These sessions are held on Mondays from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Children's Center of Hamden, 1400 Whitney Avenue. The teen meetings open to any teen with an addiction to drugs, alcohol, gambling, or other dependencies. The second meeting is for friends and family who want to help their loved ones succeed in addiction recovery. There's no charge. Donations are welcome. And you can also click to look for local meetings on another website we'll give you. And those meetings will begin to populate and spread across eight other locations in Connecticut, thanks to a grant from the CROSS Initiative. And you can check that local meeting search at smartrecoveryct.org/meetings. In the meantime, Christine, best of luck. And I'm going to check back in with you in about 6 months or so, so we can begin to promote the great successes that you're seeing with the young people who are coming in for these smart recovery sessions. So thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. Well, they say the early bird gets the worm, but when it comes to lawmakers, it's the early lawmaker out of the gate who gets the radio airtime. So after the uncharacteristic release of Governor Daniel Malloy's budget proposal 2 days before the State of the State address, which was Wednesday of this week, State Senator Tony Huang, who represents the 28th District down in Lower Fairfield County, fired off a midnight missive, which really took the governor to task on virtually all of the points, or most of the points, in his proposals. We're pleased to have Senator Huang on the phone with us today for our midpoint on the show. Senator Huang, thanks for joining us.
John, it's always a pleasure to be on with you. And yes, when I saw the data points that the governor proposed in his budget as a resolution to what we need to do moving forward July 1st, 2018, it was the same message over and over and over again. And that is, we are going to punish those that are most at risk, most vulnerable. We're going to hurt our communities through municipal aid and cuts to education, while at the same time doing it by raising more revenue and taxes on the already overburdened taxpayers of the state. And it's incredibly frustrating that in his 7 years, the formula remains the same. Blame everyone else and increase taxes on people and create a spiraling effect that is hurting our state. And yes, it was in the middle of the night, but I have to tell you, I felt that way when I saw it, and I really wanted to let the people know that the governor's vision for the state of Connecticut is not one that I share, and that I believe we can work together, as we did in the legislative body last session,
well, when people
Democrats
say,
and Republicans, to solve the solutions moving forward for the people of the state.
When people say, what keeps you up at night, the latest thing was the budget proposal. But it was interesting that the Connecticut Mirror pointed out, and I know you were at the State of the State address on Wednesday, the Connecticut Mirror, my colleagues over there pointed out in one of their reports that it almost seemed like the governor took that uncharacteristic approach of releasing the budget information 48 hours early so that he could really depart from that in the State of the State address. And your colleague, Representative Mitch Polinsky, pointed out to me just this morning as we're taping this on Thursday, that his take on this was that he didn't hear enough or even a lot that resonated in the earlier release on Monday.
Yeah, and the speech was one that is accorded to the executive of the state. And I truly respect the balance of power that we have in our state between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative branch. But we are speaking for the people. And what I have heard over and over and over again, up and down Main Street, is the fact that our state is in an economic crisis. We are at a fiscal crisis related to our budget and our deficit. We are in a crisis in regards to retaining and growing businesses and jobs. And we are not inspiring people to believe that Connecticut has better days ahead. And I hope that we have an opportunity this year to move forward. I know the governor proposed in his speech truly progressive and ideologue ideas. Look, in a perfect world, we love to have all of those, raising minimum wage and paid medical paid sick leave and all the other variety of progressive ideas. They are valued ideas. But unless you have a fundamental, predictable, and sustainable economic vitality, none of these things are ever going to happen. Or they're going to happen on the backs of people who have mobility and opportunities to leave our state. That's the frustration is there's going to be so many hard decisions that need to be made. And I was hoping that the governor would have taken it in his last term to say, I will do what is right by the people of the state and create a positive legacy moving forward instead of what he has decried when he was running of kicking the can down the road. Mm.
You also took to heart all of the proposed changes that are going to affect, as you said earlier, the state's most vulnerable individuals. And the lawmakers just went back to Hartford, it seems like yesterday, a couple weeks ago, to overturn an initiative to fund the Medicare savings program, and here it is. It is almost like the overturning of that didn't happen. It's back again. Keeps rearing its ugly head. What is the cost value relationship, do you think, in the minds of the governor and the state budget makers for continuing to go after the Medicare savings program cuts?
Well, it hurts our seniors. It disrespects our seniors. And it disrespects the legislative process that gave a clear and unambiguous issue in regards to support this for our community. Support this for our community. And what he did was, I know what's better. And again, I believe that the legislative body will stand up and address this issue with so many other issues. The problem we have in this, John, is this. It creates a environment of unpredictable, unsustainable patterns in which people who plan their lives in their health care, in their family's financial, in their ability to pay mortgages and health insurance, the bottom line is our inability to protect and create a predictable and sustainable ecosystem is hurting people, and it's driving people out of our state. It's not the weather in Florida. It is the economy and the ecosystem in our state that people do not believe that they have a future in our state. And we have to fix that. We have to fix that now.
Yeah, well, that's true, because I have a friend who just told me the other day she is soon to shake her $5,000 plus a year property taxes and all of the other onerous expenses that come with owning a home in northern Fairfield County to move down to a condo that she's owned for quite a while in Florida, where she's going to pay about $500 a year in maintenance charges and about $1,000 a year in property taxes.
Yes, and we hear that story over and over again, and we cannot turn a deaf ear to it. These are people we represent. These are our neighbors and our friends and people that contribute to our nonprofits. They're the backbone and the vitality of all the great communities that we have. And I'm going to follow with this. One of the frustrations people have with us politicians is we say no, 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 we rant and we rave. Here's the deal. There are solutions at hand. I think the first solution that we have is we need to put everything on the table. If the governor is saying that we're going to look at gas taxes and tolls and mileage taxes and raise conveyance taxes, as well as putting taxes on prescription and deducting taxes on and tires, then I would say to the governor and all of my legislative colleagues, we need to reopen up that 10-year labor guarantee that we passed in September, that we need to ask everyone to come to the table. That means the state employees, the government, the legislative branch, the executive branch, our businesses, our nonprofits. Everybody has to step up to the table, and that there are no sacred cows. If we're going to do this to move forward, if we're going to address our pensions and benefits moving forward, and to be sure that our good employees in our state get a fair dollar of salary and benefits, it's fairness. And I found it very, very interesting that the governor led his conversation with fairness. To me and the people that I represent, they don't think it's very fair for them to be taxed, to be able to unafford their health insurance, unable to afford their child's education and plans for their future, because our government is inefficient and protects special interest groups.
Great. We're going to pause on that thought for just a couple minutes, take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to touch upon the fact that the state Supreme Court basically overturned the CCJEF ruling that came down in 2016, I believe, and the rejection of the new education cost-sharing issues, as well as more thoughts from Senator Tony Huang on how a proposed budget by Governor Daniel Malloy in his final term is penalizing job creators, putting taxes on low-income working families, and increasing taxes on retirees, hurting our housing market, and more. With Senator Tony Huang, Republican from the 28th District in Fairfield County. Tony, stick with us. Folks, stick with us. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Attention volunteer firefighters. Last month, the Connecticut Volunteer Workforce Solutions Program, in partnership with the International Association of Fire Chiefs and the Connecticut Fire Chiefs Association, presented special funding opportunities available to Connecticut volunteer fire departments throughout 2018. This year, the program is offering reimbursement for National Fire Protection Association physicals, conference scholarships, training courses, and more. If you'd like more information or an application, just visit everydayherocc.org. We also want to remind you that Griffin Hospital in Derby is looking for volunteers for its Hospital Elder Life Program, HELP, which provides extra support for elderly patients. HELP is an evidence-based quality improvement program that can prevent older patients from experiencing a decline in both their physical and mental health during a hospital stay. No medical experience is needed. Training and supervision is provided. Weekday shifts are available between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Scholarship incentives are available for eligible college students. Learn more at GriffinHealth.org or just call 203-732-7466. All right. Thanks for hanging around, Tony.
Oh, no. I appreciate the opportunity. And it's just, John, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Senator Tony Huang is back with us with his remarkable take on an almost unbelievable budget proposal that was floated by Governor Daniel Malloy uncharacteristically early in the process. Normally, that shows up right around the same time as the State of the State. He took 48 hours to preview it before his State of the State, which sort of skirted a lot of the bad news for most Connecticut taxpayers and businesses that Senator Huang sees and many of his colleagues see. in this budget proposal. So, Senator Wong, we as we mentioned before the break, the CCJEF issue seems to be sort of going away like a bad storm that plagued the state and its education systems, certainly for the period of time between when the initial decision was handed down and it was overturned by the Supreme Court. But you make note of the fact that this new proposed budget rejects brand new education cost-sharing formulas that distributed funding for the first time in decades to schools based on need, population, poverty, and other factors. Boy, talk about fairness. There seems to be some real contradiction going on here.
Well, it is remarkable that, you know, one of the critical roles of government, and it is part of our Constitution, that every child in our state has an opportunity to a quality education. And what we have shown in the past and the history, and it's ironic that this is a state that was the home to Prudence Crandall, the original equal opportunity access to education for young women, is a state that has a history of, achievement gap inequality. But saying that, what we were looking to do in the legislative proposal in the last budget year was to ease off the imbalance, to be able to properly fund and create greater accountabilities for our alliance urban districts, to be able to wean away some of the inequalities the governor seems to want to accentuate by zeroing out over 30-plus communities of their education funding, to say, we're going to punish those that have run their state or towns properly and effectively and produce a quality education, and we're going to zero you out while at the same time taking care of others. What we proposed in our budget was a 10-year phase-in to get to that kind of a balance and equal distribution. It allowed our municipalities to plan. I'm a big believer in a predictable, sustainable, and transparent form of government. What the governor did and what the Supreme Court reiterated was the fact that it's a political process, and that hurts the children that we are absolutely in a mission to support and empower. So we have resorted back to politics as usual in our educational allocation, rather than following a real formula that is irrefutable and fair based upon the criterias of measure, that you and I can objectively look at a real formula that guides what we do, not on the basis of what political position you're in versus me. And we have gone that way for far too long in this state. And the only people we're hurting are the people that are most dependent on us, the children and the educational system to their success. Mm. So I believe that the Supreme Court has made their decision. Now it is incumbent for us as a legislative body to empower that we build a system that is predictable and sustainable, mm-hmm. and follows a formula that respects that every child should get a fair education.
You also have made note of the fact that at the national level, there is a big turnaround in reducing burdens on job creators. In fact, with tax reforms triggering at least in my lifetime, an unprecedented release of money from large and medium and small companies back to their workforces in terms of raises and bonuses and things like that. At the same time, it seems like in this budget, the governor figuratively picks up the ball and runs like hell toward the opposing team's goal line.
Truly inspirational leadership has no political agenda. It does what is right for the people that we represent. And the challenge we have in this is, in a speech that was full of progressive, idealistic wonderfuls, there was no reality based upon the challenge and the choices we have to make to reach that. And that's my frustration with the administration, with the vision that this governor has, is the fact that we are not doing the heavy lifting that's necessary. We're not empowering the right groups to succeed. We need to empower our businesses. We need to empower our individual small businesses. We need to empower our educational structure to allow everyone to succeed and thrive and pursue the American dream. Unfortunately, I think the governor's ideal is let's fight Washington. Let's create a political commentary so that we can go into the November elections rather than getting together and making the tough choices and fixing the problem. We can't wait till November to fix the problem of our state. We can't wait for the next governor. We have to do things now because people are leaving. People are feeling desperate.
In the last 2 minutes that we have with you, Senator Tony Huang, you are co-chair of the Senate's Housing Committee, and you have noted that one of the proposals that you'll probably be eyeballing right off the block is the proposal to increase real estate conveyance taxes, which absolutely will hurt realtors across Connecticut, real estate brokers, and the housing market itself.
Well, I am myself a realtor, and I respect that our realtors are at the forefront of a market indicator. People make investments in real estate and their homes because they see a future of 15 to 30 years. The fact that the rental market is so busy, and that we have a stagnant housing pricing market shows the fact that people don't have the confidence. And at the end of the day, here's the deal: people believe you can spin it any way you like, and with the economy booming all over this country, Connecticut has fallen behind. So regardless of how you spin it in the numbers, we don't have the vision. We don't have the confidence, and we need to start making dramatic changes right now. And I was disappointed in the governor's statement yesterday, and I hope that the legislative body will move past the politics and do what is necessary and right for the people of the state.
Excellent. Senator Tony Huang represents Connecticut's 28th Senatorial District, which actually includes Westport, the home office of Connoisseur Media. Senator Huang is a regular voice on our Connoisseur Media stations and serves as the co-chair, as we said, of the Housing Committee, vice chair of the Aging Committee, as well as the Energy and Technology Committee. He's also a member of the Judiciary and Planning and Development Committees. He will be very, very busy in the coming weeks and months as he and his colleagues throughout the State House in Hartford dig in to this final budget proposal of Governor Daniel Malloy. We'll probably have lots to talk about with you and your colleagues in the coming weeks and months, Tony. Thank you so much for your time this morning, and we trust you'll hang up and get right to work on a fix to this mess.
Well, it's a great state of Connecticut, and I'm honored and privileged to work on its behalf, and I am ready to get to work. So, John, thank you so much for the opportunity, and hope to talk to you soon.
Well, as we indicated in our introduction, we're going to wrap up our program touching base again with the folks at Sacred Heart University. We're very pleased to have on the line Leslie DeNardis. She's director of the MPA program and the Institute for Public Policy, which just a few days ago released a new poll that shows if Connecticut residents were looking for resolutions to the state's fiscal crisis, the bipartisan budget the state legislature just passed last October did very little to alleviate their concerns. And maybe today as we record this, and as you heard in the last segment with Senator Tony Huang, coincidentally also from Fairfield, if they had taken this survey today, the results might even be more concerning. And this sort of picks up where that left off. Leslie, great to meet you. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Oh, you're welcome, John. Pleasure to be here.
So just briefly, just a moment to talk about yourself and the Institute.
Sure. Thank you so much for asking. So several months ago, we decided that now would be the perfect time to develop a policy institute that was so singularly focused on policy in Connecticut. And we believe that our problems are pretty challenging, fairly acute, and I think require kind of a single-minded approach, scholarly studies and reports done in a very independent, nonpartisan way, in order to highlight problems and with the overall goal of contributing to the policy discussion in Connecticut. And so that's why we developed the Institute. And part of the Institute's mission is to issue quarterly public opinion polls, gauging Connecticut residents' feelings about a broad array of policy topics to hopefully inform leaders as they formulate public policies. We hope that we'll be a voice in that debate.
Well, and we're so pleased to partner with you to promote that voice through folks like yourself and all the folks at the Institute. So
yes.
We'll go back to October. And
sure.
Just after this agonizing and protracted budget caught the nation's attention for being the last or about the last state budget in the country to be passed.
Yes.
So in October, folks surveyed viewed 30.3% viewed the quality of life in Connecticut as decreasing. Now flash forward just 3 months later, and we're looking at that same demographic putting a 34.3% number on the tote board. Is the increase in by almost 5% in just a 3 month period in regards to a decreasing level of quality of life concerns statistically significant?
Well, I think it bears notice. I think, you know, it's not it's not a small number, and I think it really requires a hard look at, you know, what is causing this decreasing, or the perception that the quality of life is decreasing. I think policy makers should sit up and take notice about this. I think we have, as we've already noted, the highest cost, one of the highest cost of living in the nation. We have the highest taxes. And then the energy costs, I think, figured very prominently in this poll as compared to October, and probably not unsurprisingly given the winter that we've had, almost 14% found that the energy costs were really causing quite a crunch in their pocketbooks. And so that, I think that all of those things kind of contribute to, you know, one's sense of quality of life.
Now, how did the folks that you surveyed view the results of this federal tax law change, which, as we mentioned in the earlier interview with Senator Huang, looked like they triggered this avalanche of raises and bonuses and hiring over the past couple of months across the country? How did that impact the survey that you folks did at the Institute for Public Policy at Sacred Heart University?
Well, we didn't specifically gauge attitudes with respect to the federal tax bill as it impacts sort of the business climate. But what we did ask folks about is whether they sort of supported this capping of state and local tax deductions at $10,000, excuse me. And that we found to be very unpopular among respondents. About 40% of them opposed the measure.
Okay.
We didn't specifically ask a question, though, as to what they thought about in terms of, you know, would this, the federal tax overhaul, kind of unleash more activity in the business sector.
One of the other interesting points was that just a week or two ago, we had a guest on the program talking about how virtually none of the tens of millions of dollars pouring into Connecticut that's supposed to be targeted at tobacco education, especially for young people, is actually going to other programs and other buckets. You had cigarette tax question or issue in your poll.
Right. So we did. We asked respondents, how they felt about a number of proposed fee increases as a way to close the budget deficit. And one of those had to do with an increase in the cigarette tax. And I think people were generally favorable on that measure. In other words, they felt that it was something that they could support in terms of, how do you close this budget deficit?
Mm. And you have to be happy that nearly 8 out of 10 of the respondents believe the state should support institutions of higher learning in Connecticut.
I think that was, one of the silver linings in this survey, if we can find any positive news in an otherwise rather grim fiscal picture, is that Connecticut residents are very supportive of institutions of higher education, and they view them as integrally related to and linked to economic development and economic growth in the state. That is that institutions of higher education, through their training and workforce development, can contribute and help to grow the Connecticut economy. And so they didn't want to see those institutions suffering any cutbacks.
Okay. And hearkening back to what we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this earlier appearance by a representative from the Institute talking about the flight of high earners from Connecticut that's anticipated to happen or feared to be happening over the next 5 years. Your poll, I see, kind of touched a little bit on that.
Yes. Well, while that figure was pretty pronounced in our first poll, that is to say that about 49% of those higher earners indicated that they were seriously contemplating moving to a different state, we found that it decreased to 33% in January. So that was a pretty significant drop.
And once again, in such a short time, statistically significant, and what could be the drivers behind that disparity or that, kind of that rapid flux in numbers?
Sure. Yeah, I think we have to kind of speculate about that because it's hard to really say for certain. I think that perhaps it may do in part to the sense of, although the budget that was passed in October was very imperfect and highly flawed for many reasons, I think there is a sense of relief that people have when they can see that at least the leadership is coming together to carry out a basic task of government, which is to pass a budget. And so perhaps that provided some semblance of, okay, maybe we can come together and grapple with our problems in this state. Mm-hmm. That was just speculation on my part.
Yeah.
Now, if we did this, we do plan to, we're going to poll on quality of life issues repeatedly, and that's going to be one of the mainstays of our poll, because what we want to do is plot over time these trend lines and to see and maybe peg it to specific events, external events, that these responses can be sensitive to, like particular actions taken by government. Does that impact it one way or the other? It would be interesting to see, as you say before, if we were to poll again now as opposed to a month ago when they were fielding the questions, would it be any different in the wake of the budget proposal presented by the governor yesterday, which included quite a number of fee hikes, et cetera.
I see. Well, that will be something perhaps, reactions to and statistics related to points in that proposed budget may surface in a future Institute poll.
Sure.
So
I will say that, yeah. Just if I could just add one more thing.
Sure.
I will say that 33% of people seriously contemplating moving out is still not a very promising figure, and I think bears, caution and concern. Yes, it has seen a decrease over October, but it's still, I think we're still not out of the woods in terms of people's comfort levels about the overall direction of the state.
Great. And the final point, I have to say, over the past few years, I have had leaders of large, medium, and small boutique and mom and pop nonprofits and charities on the line or here in the studio, some not concerned, downright terrified over the dwindling resources that are available for them in the face of a tsunami of need that seems to be flooding into these agencies. So it was very heartening to see that despite personal financial hardships, nearly three quarters of respondents to your poll in Connecticut said they plan to make charitable donations this year, which was a great thing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a recognition among nutmeggers that we have such a very vibrant nonprofit community in this state, something like 30,000 nonprofits. And so the fact that they're really sort of, it's a vote of confidence that the fact that they are undergoing personal hardship, but yet they're still going to find funds available to support these worthy nonprofits, I think is a bright spot. And I'll add one more thing, which is that, you know, as the nonprofit community is roiled by financial turmoil, they're trying to rethink ways about streamlining or merging their operations, or even consolidating and merging with other nonprofits. Mm-hmm. They're having this, what I think is a very important conversation amongst themselves. I think the state government could sort of
take a page from that playbook,
learn a lesson, and apply that same kind of methodology as they examine their own services. Are there different ways that we can go about this more efficiently in terms of looking at the affordability question?
And a great way to leave it with a little bit of a challenge to our state lawmakers from Leslie DiNardis. She's director of the MPA program in the Institute for Public Policy at Sacred Heart University, which was established in 2017 at the College of Arts and Sciences. They're aligned with the university's new Master of Public Administration program, which will launch this fall. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to sacredheart.edu, or you could just web search Sacred Heart Institute for Public Policy to check out the full poll. Leslie, great to speak with you, and we'll
be
talking to you again soon when we get the results of the next poll. Yep. Thanks so much. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.